Okay, Shabbat Shalom and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning Bible study. I'm glad that you are here with us today. We are in a very interesting time. I think anyone who has been watching the news lately can see that there's quite a bit going on in the world around us. So I did want to kind of start off by simply reminding everyone that there is a biblical command, if you will, to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. A lot of people are watching very closely the events in the city of Jerusalem. December the 6th, the American administration did declare, based on a longstanding American Jerusalem Embassy Act from 1995 that was pushed through unanimously in the United States government, to move the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. I know that you know this. And then December the 21st, there was a vote that basically condemned that particular move of the United States administration. So I just want to remind everyone to keep Jerusalem in your prayers and think about that over the next several days and weeks and always, actually. Today, we are in the 48th chapter of the book of Genesis, the book of Bereshit. And as you well know, there are only 50 chapters in the book of Genesis, so we are pushing towards the end. In fact, I have one more class after this week that will basically wrap up the study of the book of Genesis according to the ancient triennial readings. Now, today, we are towards the end of the patriarchal narratives. We are at the end of Jacob's life. Jacob, as you'll see in Genesis chapter 48, is approaching the end of his days. I wanted to begin this morning from the prophet Hosea. If you'll go with me to the prophet Hosea chapter 12, Hosea chapter 12, I just want to read a few verses to you from that particular prophet. Hosea chapter 12, and we are going to read verses 3 through 5. It says, "And in the womb he took his brother by the heel. In his manhood he strove with God. He strove with the messenger, the Moloch, and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. He met God at Bethel, and there God spoke with us. Jehovah, the God of hosts, Jehovah is his name. So you, by the help of your God, return, hold fast to love and justice, and wait continually for your God." And then I want you to go down to verse 12. It says, "Jacob fled to the land of Aram. There Israel did service for a wife, and for a wife he herded sheep." And this particular passage from the prophet Hosea brings up a couple of interesting points that I want to begin with. The prophet Hosea is speaking here about Jacob, about the one named Yaakov, and whose later has his name changed to Israel. Jacob lived to be 147 years old, according to the biblical narrative. And his life, according to Hosea chapter 12, is summed up in reality in three events: his birth, his naming, or the, you know, where it talks about the struggle with this messenger, whose name, by the way, if you read it closely, is Jehovah of Hosts, by the way. And it talks later in verse 12 about acquiring women through whom he brings about the nation that is named for him. Now, I want you to go back with me. I want to begin today by touching on a few things from the life of Jacob as we move into the class today. So if you go to Genesis chapter 25, Genesis chapter 25, And I want to pick up in verse 23. Now, the setting is that Isaac's woman, his wife, Rebecca, is having difficulties in the pregnancy, and she goes to pray to Jehovah, and Jehovah tells her this: two nations are in your womb, and two peoples born of you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, and the elder shall serve the younger. Now, this particular passage is talking about the two boys that are in the womb, Jacob and Esau. You'll recall that in the prophet Malachi, it says, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. Now, what we're going to do is, if you go down to verse 27, it says, when the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field. Now, in the English, it says, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game. Rivka loved Yaakov, Jacob. In the English, it says here that Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. In Hebrew, the word there is tam. And tam is a word that means whole or complete. It's often translated as blameless, perfect. So the idea is not that he's quiet, meaning that he doesn't talk very much, but the general idea when you look at that word in Hebrew, tam, sometimes tamim, it means one that is whole, complete. And so what I wanted to do was to set the stage that despite Jacob's issues, if you will, because Jacob is not, like we wouldn't describe Jacob in our understanding of perfect as perfect. I mean, Jacob clearly has some things that he does, that he says, that would lead us to not call him Tom, T-A-M, Tom, not T-O-M, although it is related. So now, what I'd like to do is to show you that this is rather consistent whenever we talk about those with whom God deals. So if you'll go with me to Genesis chapter 6, Genesis chapter 6, let's just look at verse 9. It says, these are the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God. And in the English, where it says Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation, the word there is tam. The root word is tam. Tamim b'dorot tav. Whole, complete in his generation. Now, there's a debate. You know this. When we studied this months ago, there is a debate where people argue, well, was he just complete? Was he righteous in his generation? In other words, is that a relative assignment? Or was righteousness and wholeness and completeness not something that's used to be graded on a scale? And I would go with the latter. I think that Noah was tamim in his generation. He was complete. He was whole. And that's why God worked through him. Now go with me to Genesis chapter 17. Genesis chapter 17, verse 1. And Avram was 99 years old, when Avram was 99 years old, Jehovah appeared to Avram and said to him, I am El Shaddai. Walk before me, similar to what we see in the description of Noah. Noah hithalek, he walked with God, or God caused him to be walking with him, to walk about, and be blameless. I am El Shaddai, walk before me and be blameless. So there is our word again. And the idea is that this particular word indicates what God is looking for in those that serve him. Now, there's one other passage that I want to bring you to, and that is to the book of Job. And in the book of Job, in chapter 1, verse 1, it describes another man similarly. And the reason I want to do this at first is because I want to build up to the end of the days of Jacob and put him in a proper context for you. So if you look at Job chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. That man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from bad." Now, I like this idea because here we have examples from the Hebrew Bible of four people who are described as perfect, as blameless, as whole, as complete. Tam is the root word. And in each of these cases, we know these people. We know their actions. The one thing that the Hebrew Bible doesn't do is paint its characters, its heroes, as perfect in our understanding of perfect. In other words, Noah describes Noah. He's righteous in his generation. He's a righteous man. He's complete in his generation. And then a few verses down, we read Noah drank, he grew grapes and drank, got drunk and... we have this tendency to define things according to our own understanding, which is not necessarily the biblical understanding of things. So, right, what is the modern idea of being righteous and holy? And, they say, well, no one's righteous, no one's holy. But we do see people throughout the Hebrew Bible who are described as that. What about where it says, "And though the righteous stumble seven times..." What do you mean the righteous stumble? There's none righteous. Well, if there's none righteous, how could the righteous stumble? Right? So the idea is that the just and the righteous, that is the goal. And Jacob is described through all of his character flaws when we meet with him as being complete, whole. Right? Now, the story of Jacob, in a way, builds us up to this culmination of a life, and it speaks of a transition, if you will, from one who is initially known as a supplanter, one who grabs the heel. In fact, Yaakov, the root word of Yaakov is heel. So it's like at birth, remember, his brother comes out and he's grabbing hold of the heel. So he's known as a supplanter. His brother will make that charge against him after he has taken both the birthright and the blessing. You remember he cries to his father Isaac about what his brother has done to him. But we're going to watch him transition from one who is known as a supplanter, a trickster, if you will, into one who becomes a fighter. One who fights with both man and God and prevails. Yisrael, he's a fighter. And then ultimately, he becomes known as the father of 12 sons and a daughter, Dina. And those are the ones that we know, right? And then ultimately, he becomes the father of a people. Ultimately, Israel, Jacob, will become known, and we're going to get into this a little bit today, as a nation and a company of nations. A nation and a company of nations. So when we talk about Israel, we're talking about a multitude of different levels, if you will, from the historical person all the way up through the father of a company of nations, if you will. Now, go with me to Genesis chapter 47, Genesis 47 and verse 9. Now, this is from the time when Jacob appears before Pharaoh. And in verse 7, it says, "Joseph brought in Jacob, his father, and set him before Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh, and Pharaoh said to Jacob, How many are the days of the years of your life? And Jacob said to Pharaoh, the days of the years of my sojourning are 130 years. Few and bad have been the days of the years of my life, and they've not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their sojourning. His answer is quite telling. When we think of Jacob, we think of the years. He was asked, how many are the days of the years of your life? And he associates the days of the years of his life with the days of the years of his sojourning. In other words, he's been a migrant, if you will. He's really not settled. Jacob, both historically and into the modern age, is one who has moved about, all right? And this is particularly telling because when you read the story of Jacob and all the good and the bad and the ups and the downs, what do we notice here? That when Jacob is asked, he defines the days of the years of his sojournings as few and bad. Few and bad. Now, it's an interesting commentary. Now, think about some of the things that Jacob endured. And a lot of us endure hardship in life. Jacob, he in an early part of his life, he has to flee from his brother. He's hunted by his brother initially. He loses later his woman, Rachel, the one that he truly loved the most. You remember the event with Simeon and Levi associated with the what is so-called the rape of Dinah. So he has to endure this. Remember, the neighbors hated him. Not too different than the nation of Israel. But this idea, he says that you've made me odious. You know, I stink in the presence of my neighbors. And then if you follow on, he had other horrible events in his life. Reuven, his oldest son, slept with one of his women, Bilhah. And then ultimately, the thing that truly hurt him was when Joseph was stolen away and the brothers conspired against him. Joseph was 17 years old when he was stolen from Dothan and taken into Egypt. So Jacob spent 17 years with Joseph. And then you just heard in chapter 47 that when Jacob gets to Egypt, he tells Pharaoh that he's 130. We know from the account in Genesis that he dies at 147. So he spends the first 17 years of Joseph's life with Joseph, and the last 17 years of his life with Joseph. And what's the significance of that? I don't know. But it is interesting. And he spends that quality, that 34 years. They're going to be separated for many, many years. And then today, what we're going to find is that there is a sort of a passing of the blessing. So what we're going to see, just like throughout all the narratives that we've covered so far in the book of Genesis, you have at a certain time, the baton, if you will, is passed to the next key person in the story. In this case, we're going to see that that's Joseph and the descendants of Joseph. All right. Now, you'll recall, just so you have this in your note, if you go to 1 Chronicles chapter 5, 1 Chronicles chapter 5, it says, the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn, but because he polluted his father's couch, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, so that he's not enrolled in the genealogy according to the birthright. Though Judah became strong among his brothers and a prince was from him, yet the birthright belonged to Joseph. Now, this is very important in our study, especially as we move more into the prophets, to recognize that there is a distinction. Judah has his role. It's not the same role as Joseph's role. Joseph has a role. It's not the same as Judah's role. The problem is that when someone believes that they must take on the role of another. Now, what I wanted to make a very clear point, if you mark your Bible, this ought to be one of those passages because it indicates the role of both, that Judah has a role and Joseph has a role. So, we're talking about a transference of birthright and blessing. In fact, in Genesis chapter 48 and 49, we are talking about Jacob giving blessings, if you will, to his descendants before he passes. So what I'd like to do now is I would like to read from the Transparent English Bible, our reading today, which consists of the 48th chapter of Genesis. And most of you are with us every week, so you know this. The Transparent English Bible is the work of Dr. James Tabor. It is a very literal rendering. So bear with me, Genesis chapter 48, beginning in verse 1. And it was, after these things, and one said to Joseph, "Look, your father is sick." And he took his two sons with him, Manasseh and Ephraim. And one told to Jacob and said, "Look, your son Joseph is coming toward you." And Israel made himself strong and sat upon the bed. And Jacob said toward Joseph, "El Shaddai was seen toward me in Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said toward me, 'Look, it's me causing you to bear fruit and causing you to be abundant, and I will give you for an assembly of peoples. And I've given this land to your seed after you for a holding age lasting. And now your two sons who are brought forth toward you in the land of Egypt, until my coming to you toward Egypt, to me they are, Ephraim and Manasseh, as Reuben and Simeon they are to me. And those brought forth of you that will be brought forth after them, to you they are. Upon the name of their brothers they will be called in their inheritance. And I, in my coming from Padan, Rachel died upon me in the land of Canaan in the way, when still a stretch of land to go towards Ephrat. And I buried her there in the way of Ephrat," that is, Beit Lechem. "And Israel saw the sons of Joseph, and he says, 'Mi ele, who are these?' And Joseph said toward his father, 'My sons are they whom Elohim has given me in this place.' And he said, 'Take them, please, toward me, and I'll bless them.' And the eyes of Israel had become weighty from age. He was not able to see, and he caused them to draw near toward him. And he kissed them and enfolded them. And Israel said toward Joseph, I had not interceded to see your face, and look, Elohim has let me see your seed as well.' Joseph caused them to go out from between his knees, and he bowed himself toward his two nostrils toward the land. Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand, from the left of Israel, and Manasseh on his left hand from the right of Israel, and caused them to come toward him. And Israel sent his right hand and set it on the head of Ephraim, and he was the little one, and his left hand upon the head of Manasseh, discerning his hands. For Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, 'The Elohim with whom my father Abraham and Isaac walked, to his face, the Elohim, the one pasturing me from my yet being until this day, the messenger who vindicated me from all bad, bless the young men, and may my name be called in them, the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and may they grow as fish to an abundance in the middle of the land.' Joseph saw that his father set his right hand on the head of Ephraim, and it was bad in his eyes, and he held up the hand of his father to turn it aside from upon the head of Ephraim upon the head of Manasseh. Joseph said toward his father, 'Not thus, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Place your right hand on his head.' And his father refused and said, 'I know, my son, I know. He also will become a people, And he also will be large, but indeed his brother, the small one, will be larger from him, and his seed will become the fullness of the nations. And he blessed him in that day, saying, by you will Israel say blessing, saying, may Elohim place you like Ephraim and Manasseh. And he placed Ephraim to the face of Manasseh. And Israel said toward Joseph, look, I am dying, and Elohim will be with you and will cause you to return toward the land of your fathers. And I am giving to you one shoulder of land above your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite by my sword and my bow. Thus concludes the reading of Genesis chapter 48. Now, this particular passage indicates a shifting or a moving, if you will, from the patriarchs and the matriarchs to a greater house, to a family, if you will, the family of Israel, the seed of promise. Remember, this is what we've been working towards. All the way back to the time of Avram, when Avram, later known as Abraham, is taken out and he's told, look up at the stars, so shall your descendants be. The idea is that the promised seed is not a single coming figure, but a nation, a people. This is a big clue. It's not buried, it's not hidden, it's right there if we simply read. The idea is that the seed, the nation, is the goal of the blessing. In fact, from the outset of the Bible story, we know that it's truly about one man's family. The seed of Abraham, my friend, as the prophet Yeshayahu says, Isaiah. A very special family. In Amos chapter 3, it says to Israel, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. Now, people might say, well, I don't know. I don't like the way that says that. You know, God loves everyone. Well, I'm just saying what the prophet said. So it's really all are welcome. Isaiah 56 makes this very clear that Israel is the family that God's working through the instrumentality of what we call covenants. But anyone who joins themselves to the covenant is a welcomed participant. So Isaiah 56 says, and I will gather others to them besides those that are gathered. So the idea is that a non-Israelite person can be welcomed into the plan and working of the Creator so long as they take hold of the covenant. We're talking about a chosen people. We're talking about a chosen people. It's always been the plan. According to Genesis chapter 12, let's look at Genesis chapter 12. You can't talk about this family without going to the source in chapter 12, beginning in verse 1. This is where it begins. Jehovah says to Avram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a goy gadol, a great nation. And I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and him who curses you, I will curse, and by you all the families of the earth shall bless themselves or shall be blessed. People debate on how that's translated. The idea is that it begins with Avram. Isaiah the prophet says that he was one when he was called, but ultimately he became a mighty nation. This happens as we follow the patriarchal narrative from Abraham through Isaac and through Jacob and his seed. In Genesis 48 begins, El Shaddai appeared unto me. He's talking about a previous incident that is recorded in Genesis 35. So if you'll go with me to Genesis 35, let's look at that. Genesis 35, verse 9. In fact, let's start in verse 9. God appeared to Jacob again. See, notice again. So we've got one further back, but we'll start here. When he came from Paddan Aram and blessed him, and God said to him, your name is Yaakov. No longer shall your name be called Yaakov, but Israel shall be your name. So his name was called Israel. And God said to him, I am El Shaddai. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall spring from you. The land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give to you, and I will give the land to your descendants after you. There are two things that occur over and over in the patriarchal narratives. And what I would like to call your attention to is that this begins to represent the covenant with the people of Israel. It involves two main blessings, progeny and land. Progeny and land. And both of those find their place here in this particular story. Now, if you go to Genesis chapter 28, beginning in verse 9, this is from Torah reading Vayetze, and it talks about Jacob. I'm just going to paraphrase it for you. When Jacob is fleeing from his brother and he goes to a certain place, and he takes one of the stones of that place and makes it for a headrest, and he sleeps. And in his sleep, he has a dream, and God comes to him in a dream and tells him all of the things that he's going to do on behalf of Israel unto Jacob, and indicates that his people, his descendants, which, by the way, he doesn't have yet, will be scattered west, east, north, and south. That Jehovah tells him that he will go with him wherever he goes and that he'll bring him back. This is the promise to the fathers. People talk about the patriarchal promises, the promise of the fathers. This is it, right? Now, notice that in these narratives, we're talking about a God known as El Shaddai. Just go with me quickly to Exodus chapter 6. Exodus chapter 6, beginning in verse 2. And God, Exodus 6, 2, God said to Moses, I am Jehovah. Appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as El Shaddai. But by my name, Jehovah, I did not make myself known to them. The idea is that the ancient name of God, used several times in these narratives, used in the book of Job, used in some poetic passages, the name El Shaddai, Shad is a breast. Some suppose or put forward the idea that Shaddai is the nurturing one. El indicates power. It's typically translated as God, but it means might or power. So the mighty one who nurtures, if you will, El Shaddai. Now, he says, to you and to your seed after you. Now, if you look in Genesis 48, where we are this week, he tells him in this particular blessing that he will give this land to the people as an eternal possession, as an eternal possession. And let's see, let me go to this particular passage. Okay, now what I want to do is I want you to go back, hold your hand here, and go to Genesis chapter 17. We want to pick this up to show you the continuity of the promise. Chapter 17, verse 8. Says, and I will give to you and to your descendants after you the land of your sojournings. Now he's talking to Avram, right? This is even before Avram's name is changed to Abraham. He says, let's see, actually he just changed his name to Abraham when he tells him this. I will give to you and to your descendants after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan. How much of it? All. For an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. Now, throughout biblical literature, you have this idea in covenant language, I will be their God and they will be my people. Do a search for that in your biblical program. You can use Blue Letter Bible or one of these free online if you don't have Bible software. But any Bible software, just do a search. You could probably even do a Google search. Biblical phrases that say, I will be your God and you will be my people. It's amazing. It's part of the covenant, right? Now, one of the things that I wanted to mention is that whenever we look at this particular promise in Genesis chapter 48, in verse 3 of Genesis 48, I'm going to bounce around a little bit because I want to show you a couple of things. Jacob said to Joseph, 48:3, El Shaddai appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said to me, Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you. In Genesis 35, it says, Be fruitful and multiply. Genesis 48, Jacob says that God said, I am making you fruitful and multiplying you. Now, why the difference? It could be just a recognition as he reflects back that truly God has fulfilled on his behalf this promise that he made. Yes, be fruitful and multiply. Quite often in Scripture, God commands his people to do something, and then later it says that God himself will do it. I'll give you an example. Circumcise, therefore, the foreskin of your heart. And then later, he says, and I will circumcise your heart. So it means that we should make an effort to fulfill the workings of God. We should set out to bring to pass what it is that God has commanded, and then ultimately our faith, working with our obedience, will bring about God's intervention in our lives and in the fulfillment of his unfolding plan. Now, if you look, I know you're out of hands. I keep saying hold your hand here, so just don't worry about it. I mean, we're in the book of Genesis. Just flip with me. Genesis 28. Genesis 28, verse 3. El Shaddai, bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may become a company of peoples, a company of peoples. Now, this is what Isaac says to Jacob. And he makes it in this particular blessing. He also says in the blessing, he calls on God to bless and multiply, right? And notice the phrase, an assembly of peoples. In Genesis 48, that same thing occurs. I am making you fruitful, multiplying you, and giving you as an assembly of peoples. Now, what does that mean? Right? And we're gonna get into this a little bit. Now, in Genesis 48, where our reading occurs today, in chapter 48, verse 5 and 6, we begin to make a shift of focus. Jacob's days are coming to a close. And Jacob tells Joseph, Now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt are mine. He claims, sort of adopts, if you will, the two sons of Joseph. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine, as Reuven and Simeon are. The offspring born to you after them shall be yours. They shall be called by the name of their brothers in their inheritance. Now, so he basically says these two boys have been brought into the ranking of the sons of Israel. So they are exalted, if you will. They are promoted. They're advanced. Now, look at verse 8, and it says, when Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, Mi ele, who are these? And remember, his sight is dim. He can hardly see. Whenever we look at this particular phrase, it's I want you to get I want you to feel the narrative. Joseph, imagine Jacob is standing there and he sees. He barely can see. It's blurred, if you will. He sees these two young men and says, Miele, who are these? These are the ones you were just talking about. Now, I want you to go back to Genesis 41 just so that you don't lose track of the names and who they are in the narrative. These are the ones that are promoted into the ranks. Chapter 41, verse 50. Genesis 41, 50. Before the year of famine came, Joseph had two sons, whom Asnat, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. The name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. So for all intents and purposes, Joseph's boys are called fruitful and forgetful. Defining Joseph, they represent, get this, Joseph in the diaspora. They represent you. Fruitful, blessed, but forgetful, because the descendants of Joseph have been fruitful, but they have forgotten their father's house. Now, in the blessing, in chapter 48, again, the boys are brought before Jacob, Israel, whose vision is very poor. And you'll recall that so were the eyes of his father. Remember, Isaac's eyes were dim. In that case, there was a trick. Jacob was dressed as Esau. In this case, the vision is also dim. But he's got another trick up his sleeve, if you will. Trick is not the right word. But understand that the way that the boys are brought forward, if you watching me, if there are two of you in a room, two of you stand toward the screen and face me. If you're on this side, if you're approaching me, he put the eldest so that Jacob's right hand would be on the eldest. He wanted Jacob to touch Manasseh, the eldest, and bless him with his right hand. Ephraim would get the left hand. I imagine that Joseph's head is bowed, you know, because every head bowed, every eye closed. We always do this, right? No, I'm sorry. But there is this idea that there must be a respect, a very humbled approach. He brings the boys forward. What he does not realize initially is that Jacob crosses his hands, right? He crosses his hands in verse 14, and then he pronounces this blessing. It says, and he blessed Joseph. Notice now, he's got his hands on the boys, but the text says he blesses Joseph. Why is that? Because these boys are Joseph. They represent Joseph as do our children represent us. The God before whom my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, walked. The God who has led me all my life long to this day. The messenger who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. And in them let my name be perpetuated, and the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, English says, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Now, Joseph evidently looks up. He sees that Dad's got his hand on the wrong head, as he understands it. And it displeased him, and he took his father's hand. So you at home can act this out if you've got three or more people here. Joseph grabs the father's hand and attempts to move it. He's upset about this. He's, no, Dad. This is the oldest. And Joseph said to his father, not so, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head. But his father refused. And notice what he says. Verse 19, chapter 48. I know, my son, I know. He knows who the oldest is, right? Now remember in Genesis 25, the older will serve the younger. Do you find that interesting that it's happening again? Notice, I know, my son, I know, he also shall become a people. He also shall be great. Nevertheless, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. Now, it goes on to say, Jacob goes on to say that by you, the boys, Israel will pronounce blessing, saying, God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, some of my audience doesn't know that in the Sabbath prayers to this day, the Jewish people, interestingly enough, say this prayer when they bless their sons on Shabbat. Make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. Right? Now, he goes on in chapter 48 as it wraps up. Israel says unto Joseph, verse 21 and further, that he's about to die and God's going to be with him and bring you again to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I've given you, given to you rather than to your brothers, one shoulder, I think is the way you might translate it, one mountain slope. The Hebrew there is Shechem. Shechem. Now, the place Shechem, notice it says, which I took from the hand of the Amorites with my sword and with my bow. What's he talking about there? Now, Jacob is sort of a mystical man. I mean, we get these stories, especially in next week, where he's going to prophesy on the descendants, and we get all these interesting stories there. But he talks about this, and what is he talking about? The place Shechem is described in chapter 33 of Genesis, verses 18 through 20. And there you'll recall that he purchases this piece of land. Doesn't necessarily take it by sword, but you know, different commentators will debate, well, what, why does it read differently? Was it that later he had to fight for it or what? But the idea is that Shechem belongs to the children of Joseph, particularly Manasseh. In Joshua chapter 24, verse 32, we even read that that's where Joseph's bones were ultimately brought and buried, in Shechem. Shechem is a troublesome spot now. It is in Samaria and what some people refer to as the West Bank. We don't call it the West Bank here. We call it Samaria, which is the ancient name. In fact, Shechem at one point was the capital for the northern tribes of Israel. Now, what I want to do now is go into a little bit closer look at this blessing. And many of you know this, but one cannot read chapter 48 of Genesis and not focus on two things that I think are very, very interesting. Number one, it says in 48 verse 16, my English translation says, the angel, the messenger who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, and in them let my name be perpetuated, and the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Now, the first thing I want you to notice is that this indicates to me a scattering. In other words, whatever it means to grow, some translations say team, into a multitude, they're going to become many in the midst of the earth. Okay? Remember, that goes back to Genesis 28. West, east, north, south. Now, furthermore, and Tabor brings this out in his translation, that the root word there that's translated, let them grow or team, is rooted in the idea, the root word in the English, or the root word in the Hebrew is dag, dag. Well, dag means fish. It means fish. So what is it that this is saying? In this particular, in the Hebrew, it says, Vayidgu l'rov b'kerev ha'aretz. And it's kind of hard to translate. Vayidgu, and let them multiply as fish. Or, in other words, the image that the writer wants you to get is, if you look at them, you ever see like a National Geographic where schools of fish are just, oh, they're so thick, and they're swimming together. It's almost as if they're being guided, and they turn together, and they. But the idea is that they will become many, 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 many in the midst of the earth as fish. Now, I want you to go with me to Jeremiah chapter 16. Beginning in verse 14, in the white space, it says, therefore, behold, the days are coming, says Jehovah, when it will no longer be said, as Jehovah lives who brought up the people of Israel, the land of Egypt, but as Jehovah lives who brought up the people of Israel, the north country, and out of all the countries where he had driven them, for I will bring them back to their own land, which I gave to their fathers. White space. The idea is that, by the way, Jehovah Chai is an oft-repeated phrase. It's an ancient oath. And Jeremiah says that this must be restored, by the way, swearing in the name of Jehovah. But it says that no longer will this oath be made, Jehovah lives who brought the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt. You're not even going to say that anymore. Why? Because what's going to happen will cause that event to pale in comparison. Then no longer will it be said, because what's going to be said is, Jehovah lives who brought the children of Israel out of all the lands into which they've been driven. All the lands. Now how, the question becomes, how is that gathering going to take place? I believe that what follows, though I don't claim to have it all figured out, I think it indicates sort of a pattern as to how it might happen. Look at the next verse, verse 16. We're talking about the gathering of this group. Behold, I am sending for many fishers, says Jehovah, and they shall catch them. Now, why are they fishing for people? If I were a messianic pretender, I would begin my ministry by saying, follow me, and I'll make you fishers of men. Why? Because this is how it starts. If you want to bring about the redemption, I believe you're going to fish for these people. Now, what does that mean? I don't know. We can talk about that another day when we get into some prophecies. Now, the next passage, the next phrase is that it gets into, let me finish. Behold, I'm sending for many fishers, says Jehovah, and they shall catch them. And afterwards, I will send for many hunters, and they shall hunt them from every mountain and every hill and out of the clefts of the rock. For my eyes are upon all their ways. They are not hid from me, nor is their iniquity concealed from my eyes. So forth and so on. Now, some people say, no, this isn't a happy-go-lucky fishing for people and putting out a good message and drawing them in because it talks about God punishing and so forth. Well, what it says, whether you agree with the interpretation or not, is that the bringing in, the initial phase of the bringing in of this group begins by sending fishers. Now, back in antiquity, they didn't fish with a Zebco 202 and catch them one at a time, right? It was done with a net where you brought in a massive amount. Hunting was a little more singled out. So you do your own seeking as to what that might mean. But the idea is that somehow that making them grow, that they will grow as fish, is very interesting to me in Genesis, in the prophecy of Jacob, when you consider this passage in Jeremiah. Now, in Genesis 48, verse 19, it says, let's go ahead and read that, Genesis 48, 19. This is after Joseph realizes that the hand is on, that the right hand is on Ephraim and the left hand is on Manasseh, and he tries to change it. Verse 19, but his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people. He also shall be great. Nevertheless, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants, listen to me, shall become a melo hagoyim, a multitude of the nations, or a fullness of the Gentiles, or a fullness of the nations. Now, it talks about this particular group becoming a fullness of the Gentiles, of the nations. So let's get this straight. We have the descendants of Joseph also just having been elevated to the descendants of Israel, the seed of Rachel, if you will ultimately be like fish among the nations. I think it's Micah talks about like dew among the grass. It's like this covering. And literally, this group will become mellow means full or multitude. It's the idea again, of this vast amount of the nations. Now, what does that mean? I believe that both of these give us a prophetic glimpse for Ephraim and Manasseh, the descendants of Joseph, being among the nations in the latter days. Now, some have pointed out that these particular phrases are found in the Christian writings, which I found quite intriguing many years ago. It is what pulled me more into the Hebrew faith. So I have to tell you that whenever I think about at least the gospel narratives as they've come to us, I find it very interesting that straight out of the gate, according to the gospel narratives, Jesus of Nazareth, Yeshua, begins by declaring this idea of fishing for people. Now, I'm not concerned with what people believe about the historicity or the whatever, the veracity of the gospels. That's not my point. I'm not Christian. I'm simply making an observation that it is very powerful when you think about the fact that he is, in my opinion, appealing to a prophecy in Jeremiah about this restoration. And he talks later, as you know, about the lost tribes, lost sheep of the house of Israel, which is from Jeremiah chapter 50. He liked Jeremiah, what can I say? Now, the other thing that I find interesting from a Christian perspective, I mean, we have Christians that log in and listen. Some of you may know this, but for many, many years we've been talking about this. In the book of Romans, chapter 11, verse 25, this phrase in the Hebrew, we have Hebrew, not original, the oldest manuscripts are Greek, but any time that you read a Christian New Testament in Hebrew, Romans 11, 25 in Hebrew mentions Melo HaGoyim. Now, by the way, there are only two places in ancient literature of which I'm aware that mention Melo HaGoyim, the fullness of the Gentiles. Only two in all of ancient literature. If you know of another, send it to me. I'll add it to my notes. Genesis chapter 48, verse 19, and Romans chapter 11, verse 25. Now, what does that mean? I don't know, other than to say that many, many people, I believe, from Christianity are beginning to wake up and they're beginning to enter into an identity crisis. They're being drawn back to things Hebraic. They're being pulled into the Torah. They are being drawn into all of these elements of Hebrew faith. They are led back to the ways of Hashem. And I would argue, and have for about 20-some-odd years, that these are, in fact, the workings of the Creator. But again, we'll get more into that, especially when we talk about some of the deeper things of the prophets, which I hope to get into in the next few weeks. Now, Ephraim is the name that is later ascribed to the house of Israel, the northern kingdom. Ephraim is the chief of the Joseph tribes and the leader of the 10-tribe kingdom in the north. Ephraim gets a place of preeminence. I think my life was forever changed in the early 90s when a friend of mine named Dennis Hartner, he and Mark Lloyd, Mark, I hope you're with us today, they came to my house. And Dennis asked me a simple question. He said, "What is it about Ephraim? There's something about Ephraim." So, what do you mean there's something about Ephraim? This was, I'm thinking, I don't know, maybe Mark remembers. It was the early 90s. But I didn't, you know, in my mind, I thought, well, Ephraim, it's Joseph's son that was born to him in Egypt, and it became a name, you know, for the northern kingdom, but it didn't. He said, no, 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 there's something else there. And he really kept pushing it. And I remember I went into my Bible program and I printed to prove that it's, you know, I mean, what's the big deal? On an old dot matrix printer. This is how long ago it was, right? And I clicked print, and a printer printed and printed and printed and printed and printed. And I read all that night. And at the end of the night, I remember thinking, this is the key to all of biblical prophecy. Understanding who Ephraim is the key to unlocking biblical prophecy. And by the way, Ephraim is not even mentioned in the book of Exodus and Leviticus. Not a single time. Now, Ephraim, over the course of biblical history, rises to its rightful place. I'm just going to hit a couple of high points. If you go with me to the prophet Ezekiel, to Ezekiel chapter 37, which, by the way, Ezekiel 37, a nod to those who follow the annual cycle of readings today. The annual cycle of Torah readings is Vayigash. We covered some of this last week, right? In Vayigash, where Judah draws near, which I also saw as a sign of the end of times, if you will, the prophet reading for that ultimate reunion of the family between Joseph and Judah, right? The prophet reading assigned to this particular portion is Ezekiel 37. So I find that quite interesting. Now, if you look at, I'm not going to read the whole thing because I've covered this many, many, many lessons. But beginning in verse 15 of Ezekiel 37, and it says very clearly, Son of man, the word of Jehovah came to me, Son of man, take a stick and write on it for Judah and the children of Israel associated with him. Notice, not specifically, not just Judah, but there are some others mixed with Judah. Judah and all those associated with it. Now, and then take another stick and write on it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim. See, I like the way it says it. Joseph, for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and all the house of Israel associated with him, and join them together into one stick that they may be one in your hand. And people are going to ask you and say, will you not show us what you mean by these? Say this to them, thus says Adonai Jehovah, behold, I'm about to take the stick of Judah, which is in the hand of Ephraim, right, and the tribes of Israel associated with him, and I will join with it the stick of Judah and make them one stick that they may be one in my hand. And it goes on and it talks about how ultimately God is going to bring the two sticks together in his hand. By the way, in context, this parable, hand equals land. Two sticks in one hand equal two tribes or two collections of people in one land. Now, this is perhaps one of the greatest of biblical prophecies, and I do believe that we are at the very least beginning to see the beginning stages of this, just as I believe that we are seeing the beginning stages of the dry bones. So I think that there is an awakening going on, a rattling, if you will, bones coming together and so forth, which, by the way, is driving me to begin something new at the beginning of the year that I haven't come up with a name for other than Thus Saith Jehovah, because what causes that restoration? He tells the prophet that he is to speak what? The word of Jehovah, right? It says very clearly, verse 4, of chapter 37, Ezekiel, and he said to me, prophesy to the bones and say to them, O dry bones, hear the word of Jehovah. And I believe that right now, so many religious organizations, Christian and Jewish and other, are so focused on what sages and wise people say, and they are not at all focused on thus saith Jehovah, that is stunting and inhibiting the reunion of the two sticks. And what this world needs, what this group needs, is to hear thus saith Jehovah. That's what is needed. That's what's going to bring about the restoration. And I hope and pray that many, many people are awakened to the same realization, and that all over the internet and in churches and synagogues and everywhere, that people begin to preach straight from the Hebrew Bible. Now, Jeremiah chapter 31, please. Jeremiah 31, one of my favorite chapters in one of my favorite books. Jeremiah 31. I'm not going to read the entire thing, but I will hit a few high points. Begin in verse 7, Jeremiah 31. Thus says Jehovah, sing aloud with gladness for Yaakov, and raise shouts for the chief of the nations. Proclaim, give praise, and say, Jehovah has saved his people, the remnant of Israel. Behold, I will bring them from the north country and gather them from the farthest parts of the earth, Louisiana. Among them, it didn't really say Louisiana, I just added that. Among them, the blind, the lame, the woman with child, and her who is in travail together, a great company, they will return here. With weeping they shall come, and with consolations I will lead them back. I will make them walk by brooks of water in a straight path, in which they shall not stumble. For I am a father to Israel, and Ephraim is my firstborn. Now, by the way, this is Jehovah speaking. Jehovah says he's going to bring them back. And he says very clearly that Ephraim is his firstborn son. Now, around the world, these texts that I'm going through quickly as I close today will be preached from pulpits all around to define a certain person as God's son. What I'm talking about is God's firstborn, Ephraim and Israel. When you get down into verse 15, again, set off by the white spaces, thus says Jehovah, a voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel is weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted for her children because they are not. Listen to me. Why is Rachel weeping? We've covered this several times over the last several weeks, but I want to make it clear. Rachel is weeping for her son who is not. Now, this is translated and mistranslated and misinterpreted by just about every religious group. This is not talking about the Jewish people, technically. It's not. It's talking about the sons of Rachel. Benjamin, right? And Joseph. By Joseph, I mean Ephraim and Manasseh. This is not talking about an edict to kill all the babies. It's not. Because she's weeping for children who are not. But look what it says. Thus says Jehovah. This, by the way, don't be mad at Ross. Be mad at Jehovah. Thus saith Jehovah. Keep your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears, for your work shall be rewarded, says Jehovah. They shall come back from the land of the enemy. There is hope for your future, says Jehovah. Your children shall come back to their own country. These kids aren't dead. They're just gone. But they're coming back. You see that? I mean, that's what it says. Thus says Jehovah. I'm just reading it. Now, we're talking about Joseph. We're talking about the children of Joseph and Rachel. Now watch verse 18. I have heard Ephraim bemoaning. This is what Ephraim says. If you're Ephraim, this is what you say, by the way. You have chastened me, and I was chastened, like an untrained calf. Bring me back that I may be restored, for you art Jehovah my God. For after I had turned away, I repented, and after I was instructed, I smote upon my thigh. I was ashamed, and I was confounded, because I bore the disgrace of my youth. Is Ephraim my dear son? Is he my darling child? For as often as I speak about him, I do remember him still. Therefore, my heart yearns for him. I will surely have mercy on him, says Jehovah. We're talking about God bringing his son back. A son that was thought to be dead, but is alive. A son who's been gone for more than 2 days, but on the third day, God will raise him up. That's Hosea chapter 6. It's talking about Israel. God's son is Israel. His firstborn is called Ephraim. Go with me to Hosea. Hosea chapter 11. Beginning in verse 1. When Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. Now, again, a lot of people are going to be talking about this on Sunday. An infant rescued from Egypt. Right? I mean, I'm right. Shake your head 12 to 6. That's exactly what they're going to be talking about. The more I called them, the more they went from me. They kept sacrificing to Baal and burning incense to idols, yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. Took them up in my arms, but they did not know that I healed them. He goes on and on and on. Verse 8, how can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? The idea that's conveyed here in this particular passage is that these texts, thus saith Jehovah, when God speaks of his son, who is despised and rejected, who is mistreated, he's talking about Israel. He's talking about Ephraim. But God promises to bring his son back. That is exactly what we're talking about today. Israel, we're introduced to him as a tom man, whole and complete. He describes his days as few and bad. We see Jacob go from a supplanter to a fighter to the father of a nation. God first deals with Jacob in a dream in Genesis 28. And he says in chapter 28 of Genesis that the seed Israel would break forth west, east, north, and south, that ultimately they would be among the nations as fish. They would become melo hagoim, a fullness of the Gentiles, if you will. Lost their identity, forgotten their resting place. Jeremiah says they've forgotten their fold. See, Joseph's descendants were named fruitful and forgetful. But what happens, though, is that Deuteronomy 30 makes this clear. Moses says that when all these things happen to you, the blessings and the curse, and you, English says, call them to mind among the nations into which you've been scattered. What it really says there is once you return to your heart, God will gather you in. I'm asking people, I'm appealing to your heart to hear the words that the prophets have spoken, to respond to the call that the prophets put forth. Whenever the scripture says, thus saith Jehovah, he is talking to your heart. When the redemption begins in Isaiah chapter 40, it says, speak tenderly to the heart of Jerusalem. Warfare is over. Look, it doesn't mean that bad things still can't happen, but what I feel, what I sense, is that it's time for God's people to respond from the heart. And I think that that's what's going to change the world. I don't think it's an accident that the U.S., which is so much a part, I believe that many of the descendants of Joseph are here. You can't tell them by race or color. Remember, red and yellow, black and white. Amos says, sifted through all the nations. I'm not saying the U.S. represents Joseph. I'm saying that many of Joseph are here, I believe. And I don't find it at all a surprise when I see Joseph standing alongside Israel, the nation that we know is Israel, in a group that voted 128 against or for in favor of condemning Israel in the U.S., 9 in favor and 35 abstentions. That's 172 out of the 193 nations. I'm surprised that 9 voted against, to be honest with you. I'm surprised that 35 abstained. But I'm telling you, the prophets predict a time when all nations, that Jerusalem will be a stone of stumbling, a cup of trembling. And I believe that those who stand with Israel and that those who are awakening, recognizing their connection to these ancient stories, if it comes down to just 2 against and 191 in favor of condemning, then so be it. Because all God needs to bring this together is 2 sticks. 2 sticks. Judah and Joseph. The day, one day it will no longer be said that Jehovah lives who saved his son from one nation stronger than they are. But Jehovah lives who saved his son from all nations. Shabbat shalom.